KPCW News time is now 8:06. Listen to the local news hour. Let's see what's going on with the weather. Here's a report from Cedric Haynes.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for a look at your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Friday. We're looking at partly to mostly cloudy skies as we move throughout your Friday. You're going to notice temperatures climbing into the low 70s only in Park City and high temperatures in the upper 70s. We may touch 80 briefly in the Heber Valley. Now, with those clouds that'll be building, and I think it's mainly dry for the rest of today, but there is going to be about a 10% chance late this afternoon or early Friday evening for a isolated pop-up shower to develop. But I think later chances of rainfall will increase as we get towards your Friday night, overnight into your Saturday, especially during the midday and afternoon hours on Saturday. I think it's going to be a pretty good chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms developing across the Wasatch back. So that means you're going to want to make sure you have those ponchos and umbrellas close by if you've got any outside plans as we go throughout your Saturday. High temperatures on Saturday will climb to near 70 in Park City. We'll see those highs in the mid-70s for us in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Sunday, look for partly cloudy skies. Temperatures will climb to near 70 again in Park City, and we'll see those highs in the mid-70s in the Heber Valley. We'll have another chance of isolated showers and storms developing for your Sunday, so not a complete washout for the weekend by any means, but there will be the chance of pop-up showers and storms both Saturday and Sunday across the Wasatch back, so just keep that in mind for your outdoor activities. Now, as we head into next week, high pressure starts to build back in across the area, so we'll start to clear things out and dry things out. Will return to the sunshine out there across the area as high temperatures will warm back into the 70s in Park City, and we'll see those highs warming into the upper 70s to lower 80s as we get towards the Heber Valley. Again, we'll see lots of sunshine once we get into next week. So the first official week of fall as we bring in autumn on with the autumnal equinox on Monday is looking like it's going to feel more like summer again across portions of the Wasatch back. Let's look at your latest forecast. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
You're listening to the local news hour. Coming up, I'm going to be speaking with Taylor Codell. She's with the Utah Department of Health and Human Services Office of Substance Abuse and Mental Health. We're going to be talking about coping with grief and reaction to tragedy. Then Utah State University Extension Professor Katie Wagner will be on to talk about the fall colors. We'll finish our hour by speaking with Jeff Dreyfus. He's the new rabbi at Temple Har Shalom. Stay tuned. Recycle Utah's general manager has stepped down. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the search for a new leader begins immediately.
Recycle Utah said on Thursday general manager Jim Bedell has left the nonprofit to focus on his retirement. Bedell led the Park City organization for over a year. Previously a board member, Bedell took on a leadership role in June 2024 when the previous executive director, Carolyn Wara, experienced health issues. He officially became Recycle Utah's general manager in January. In a statement, board chair Ken Barfield said he and the board of directors are deeply grateful for Bedell's service, leadership, and passion for Recycle Utah. Barfield said Bedell's, quote, strategic thinking helped Recycle Utah to envision a comprehensive waste management relocation to best serve the needs of our growing community. He also said Bedell's dedication left an enduring mark on the organization and community. The search for a new executive director begins immediately. According to the statement, Recycle Utah's board will jointly lead the organization until a new director is hired. According to its website, Recycle Utah was incorporated by a group of Park City locals in 1990. The organization recycles over 3.5 million pounds of material annually, including cardboard, glass, electronics, and recreation equipment like skis. The nonprofit has long operated from an old bush shed on a 0.04-acre lot in Park City's Bonanza Park neighborhood. That facility is set to close in September 2026 as the city plans to redevelop the area. A new location has not been selected, although the city has offered the organization a 4-acre parcel off US 40. In recent months, Bedell has pushed both city and county leaders to invest in a long-term plan for addressing recycling, including investing in diversion infrastructure that would keep more materials out of the county landfill. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Park City plans to start installing a new protective net between Thames Canyon Drive and the driving range next month. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more on the project.
Earlier this year, the Park City Council voiced support for building the net to protect against errant golf balls. Thames residents have been in favor of the new net after years of dealing with shanks and slices at the local driving range. Adding to the safety risk, Park City just completed a new 12-foot-wide pedestrian path on Thames Canyon Drive along the perimeter of the driving range. The 600-foot-long net will taper in height from 25 to 50 feet, blending in with the natural slope west to east. The city intends to minimize the visual impact of the net by planting dozens of trees and shrubs, according to a staff report. In August, Park City's Board of Adjustment approved a variance for the net as it exceeds the 28-foot maximum height allowed in the area under the land management code. That month, the Park City Planning Commission also approved a permit for the net's installation. The net will be installed in two phases. In mid-October, crews will excavate and pour the foundation for the net's poles, which is expected to take around 8 to 10 days. In early December, the net will be installed. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
The tragic shooting death of Charlie Kirk was a traumatic event that has affected many Utahns profoundly. The Utah Department of Health and Human Services has a variety of crisis resources that are available to anyone who might need help. On the phone to talk about it is Taylor Codell, the Program Administrator for Crisis Services of the Utah Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Substance Use and Mental Health. Wow, that's a mouthful. Good morning, Taylor.
Good morning. Good job.
All right. So, Taylor, let's start by discussing the ways in which the human brain processes tragedy and trauma.
Yeah, so I think it's different for everybody, and it's also different developmentally, right? So children and adults are going to process trauma differently. For children, you know, they're not as experienced with things, and so they may have a hard time understanding what's going on. You might see a lot of behavioral differences in them. Maybe physically they're not sleeping well. They become more clingy, things like that, where adults, they're, you know, again, trying to process things a little bit different or trying to understand things, but you're going to be seeing a wide range of symptoms that come up with them.
What are some of the symptoms we see? Let's start with adults. What are some of the symptoms we see in adults when they're trying to process something like a tragedy or a trauma?
Yeah, so everybody's unique, so it's going to be different for everyone. But there, some of the things that you might see are, you know, flashbacks. They might have nightmares. You see a lot of anxiety or avoidance. You see differences in behaviors. Sometimes people get more irritable. They're sad. Things like that.
And what about, do older adults process trauma and tragedy differently than sort of middle-aged adults?
Yeah, they can. A lot of the times older adults maybe are a little bit more resilient. They've had more life experiences. One of the things that we see in maybe older adults is they're not recognizing that they're having these symptoms or they tend to minimize their symptoms.
Okay, so obviously a trauma happens, we have these reactions. What do you do to try to recover? What does that recovery process look like?
Yeah, so unfortunately there's not a magic pill or a step-by-step guide that works for everyone. I wish there was. And again, everyone's unique and recovery looks different for everyone. But some of the things as parents or as guardians of people, for children, we can, you know, really create a safe environment. We can create predictable routines for people or for the children. We can encourage communication, validate them, listen, and just really model healthy coping skills for those children. And in adults, I think it's just practicing self-care, recognizing and acknowledging that you're experiencing those emotions, you know, limiting exposure to maybe social media or the news, connecting with others, all of that.
Yeah, that's what I really wanted to ask you about is what are some of the sort of, you know, steps that you can take? What are some of the proactive things that people should do to facilitate recovery?
Yeah. So again, it's different with everyone, but we really want to make sure that we are checking in with ourselves and giving ourselves grace. Trauma, you can start experiencing symptoms immediately, or sometimes it creeps in a couple days after. It's very similar to grief in how we process things. And so, again, practicing self-care, and I think just connecting with others, engaging in activities, finding ways to help others is often a good thing, and just limiting yourself to outside exposure, social media, all of that.
You know, while there's no magic bullet, it sounds like there are healthy ways to facilitate recovery, things that you can do to make yourself feel better.
Yeah. And I think there's a few ways. You know, when you start experiencing some of those emotions, if they become a little bit too much, you can seek professional help.
Yeah.
If you start noticing that your symptoms are worsening, that they're interfering with your daily life, or that you're turning to other coping skills like drugs, alcohol, arming yourself, things like that, I think that's the time to really seek help.
I was going to say, I want to get eventually some of the resources that are available, but it sounds like, you know, like you said, if you're turning to what I would call destructive coping skills, things like alcohol, that might be a time to look for some help.
Yes, absolutely. And you'll be able to know. I mean, you know your daily routine, right? And so if you start seeking those things more, maybe you're drinking more than you normally would, or maybe you didn't drink at all and you're starting to drink. You just start recognizing those things. Maybe we see it a lot with eating, right? Like normally we would just have a few chips, but if we're eating the whole bag and we're eating constantly, or we're just getting lost in our phone, things like that, just things outside of your routine that you wouldn't normally do that are now starting to affect your daily routine.
And what about identifying others who you think are struggling? What can you do to support a friend or a loved one who you see is struggling?
Yeah, that's super important. So checking in and listening with empathy. So we want to be a good listener. We want to let them know that we are there for them. Avoid cliches. So those things like, you know, everything happens for a reason. I'm so sorry that happened. And we want to encourage practical help and professional help. So practical help would be, you know, help with daily tasks, or if they need professional help, maybe offering to help them find a therapist or contacting 988 with them, sitting down and saying, hey, you know, it looks like you're struggling. Let's call 988 together. And then we just want to make sure that we're respecting privacy and boundaries. So we don't want to force people into sharing things with us. We just want to be respectful of them.
And so, Taylor, when it looks as though somebody needs some help, or if you need some help, what are some of the resources that we have here in Utah that can help people cope and with this kind of a trauma or this kind of a problem?
Yeah. So the first thing I'm going to say is 988. You can call or text. It's as simple as the number 988. We like to tell people that they define the crisis. We don't. So there's no crisis too big or too small. If you feel like, if you're even having an inkling that you need to call or text and you want some resources or support, just give them a call. And that would be the first line I would say. They can, connect you to whatever you need, whether that be just an outpatient therapist, or maybe you need, a mobile crisis outreach team to come and talk to you. And get you some help and resources in person.
Okay.
And then we do have Safe UT apps. So a lot of people have heard of that for students, but we also have Safe UT for frontline workers, for members of the National Guard and their families, and, of course, for students.
Okay.
And then the Warm Line as well. If you don't feel like you're in a crisis but you want to talk to someone, you can contact the Warm Line at 833-773-2588.
And who operates the Warm Line?
Yeah, so that would be Huntsman Mental Health Institute. They actually operate both the 988 call center as well as the Warm Line. So they have a large majority of professionals that are there to answer questions, get resources. They're all trained to handle these types of calls. And so there's, again, no issue, big or small, that they can't handle.
And is that the kind of resource that one could use when somebody says, hey, I think I need some help, but I don't know how to find a mental health professional? Are there some resources available to sort of help you find someone?
Yeah, so you could call them for that. There's also behavioral health service navigation centers. You can call your insurance company if you need to and talk to a professional there that can link you. And then we have Healthy Mind Utah is the questioner. So but the Behavioral Health Service Navigation at 833-442-2211 for adults and 801-313-7711 for kids and teens, and they can help navigate that.
Now, has the Office of Mental Health Services seen a spike in demand after the shooting of people seeking help?
Yes.
Okay. And have you undertaken some special activities to support people?
Yeah, we're just trying to really push out resources to let people know that we're here, we're listening, and that we have resources to support. So that's our number one priority, is just the people here in Utah and getting them access to services.
Okay, once again, let's remind the listeners of where they can go to find help. If you're not in a critical, if you're in a critical situation, you start with 988.
Yeah. So 988 is for anyone. It's our suicide and crisis lifeline. If you feel like you are struggling, if you're feeling those symptoms of being overwhelmed, that you're starting to go into a crisis, all of that, you can call 988. You can also text or chat them, and they can get you connected to resources.
Okay.
We have the Safe UT apps that you can download. So Safe UT for students, Safe UT for frontline workers, and Safe UT for members of the Utah National Guard and their families. If you are feeling like you just want to talk, there are peers on the warm line that are there to support you, and you can contact them between the hours of 8 a.m. and 11 p.m. every single day. And that number that you would call is 833-773-2588. And then you can also contact the Behavioral Health Service Navigation if you're looking for support. This is sponsored by Intermountain for finding mental health professionals. For adults, that number would be 833-442-2211. And for kids, that would be 801-313-7711.
And for our listeners who are not standing by their radios prepared with a paper and pencil, what website can they go to just find all the a compendium of these resources?
Yeah. So they can go to, there's a few different ones that they can go to. I would start with 988. So we have 988.utah.gov, and they can go there and get connected. HMHI, or Huntsman Mental Health Institute, and Intermountain have published a list of providers, and that would be the Intermountain Healthcare/Services/Behavioral Health or healthcare.utah.edu/HMHI.
Taylor Cadell, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you so much for having me.
We'll be right back after this. We have a story from Connor Thomas about what's going on in the basin.
District Director Dana Jones says Basin Recreation's goal is to make smaller tax increases more frequently to avoid sticker shock.
We don't want to wait for 10 years and all of a sudden have to ask for a big chunk. We did it in 2019. We did it again in 2022, where we asked for a 19.9%. This time, it's again 3 years later. We're going to ask for a 15%.
It works out to $3.35 extra per year for every $100,000 of a property's taxable value. Full-time residents are only taxed on roughly half their home's assessed value. Basin Rec says the increase would fund new employee salaries and ongoing costs, such as facilities maintenance and insurance.
I mean, everybody knows that insurance is going up, and ours has doubled in the last, over the last year even.
Basin Rec will send informational postcards to residents next month and is scheduled to share more details at the October 8th Summit County Council meeting. The council must approve Basin Rec's tax level since it's the district's governing board. A public hearing on the matter is scheduled for December 10th. Summit County and Basin Rec are financial supporters of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Wasatch County leaders adopted a new emergency response plan this week. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has more.
Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh says the emergency management plan has been in the works for 2 years.
It's a lot more robust than what we've had in the past. It was done in partnership with a lot of stakeholders around in the community, including the hospitals, the health department, the cities, and first responders.
Wasatch County last updated its emergency plan in 2013. It also drafted a disaster mitigation plan with neighboring Utah County in 2022. The plan provides county leaders with a roadmap for deciding what type of emergency response is warranted, details about different levels of emergency status, and who's responsible for different tasks during a crisis. It has details about how to alert the public to emergencies and a list of partner agencies who could help. Graybaugh said he hopes the new plan spurs more collaboration with cities and towns across Wasatch County.
Our hope is that each of the cities will also adopt a similar plan that can kind of plug into ours so that we know how to cooperate with each other during those same circumstances.
The Wasatch County Council voted unanimously to adopt the emergency management plan at its meeting Wednesday. Next, leaders will determine a schedule for how often to train staff in emergency protocols. Training will vary based on department. A link to the new Wasatch County Comprehensive Emergency Management Plan is available at kpcw.org. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
How does one move forward after trauma? In a funny, heartfelt, brilliant debut by writer, director, and star Eva Victor, Sorry Baby takes on the complicated challenge of surviving. Helen Nadel has this week's Friday Film Review.
A bad thing happened to Agnes. The trauma of how or whether a smart, quirky young woman moves on is the subject of Sorry Baby. Hearing that, some people might run in the opposite direction. But Sorry Baby is a don't-miss movie to run towards. Despite its weighty theme, the film is bracing, tender, and often laugh-out-loud funny. Getting the tone right in as complex a story as this is no small feat, and the film nails it every time. Screened at Sundance in 2025 and winner of the Waldo Salt Screenwriting Award, U.S. Dramatic, Sorry Baby is the first film by Eva Victor, who wrote, directed, and stars in it. The movie was the subject of an intense bidding war, eventually won by A24, and it's easy to see why. The movie opens with Agnes, played by Victor, awaiting a visit from her best friend, Liddy, beautifully played by Naomi Ackie. Agnes is a young, tenured professor teaching at the same university where she and Liddy were graduate students in writing. While Liddy has moved to New York, settled with a partner, and has a child on the way, Agnes still lives in the same little house on top of a hill that she and Liddy shared years before. Their close friendship is at the core of this movie, and it's a joy to hang out with them, share their jokes, and learn their history. The film asks, what does moving on really mean? If you stay physically in the same place, how does that impact healing? Early on, Liddy asks Agnes tentatively, are you okay? And quickly observes, it's a lot to still be here. Agnes makes a quick retort, it's a lot to be anywhere. And so the movie unfolds, moving between four nonlinear sections over a three-year period. The year with the baby, the year with the bad thing, the year with the questions, the year with the sandwich. The bad thing, never named, never shown, swirls through Agnes's life, even as she succeeds professionally and connects romantically. Part of the movie's genius is its resistance to a simple, straight line of trauma to recovery, and its insistence, much like Agnes's own, that she is not simply a victim. Humor helps, and this film is funny, very funny. Victor began her career as a comedy writer, and it shows in the film's dry wit, absurd moments, and sharp dialogue. Each of the characters is nuanced, and the performances are uniformly excellent. Sorry Baby is visually arresting, with saturated colors, lighting that aligns perfectly with the scene's mood, and clean visual framing. Music perfectly underscores the film's emotional currents. The film also stars Louis Cancelmi, Kelly McCormack, Lucas Hedges, and John Carroll Lynch. Sorry Baby is rated R for language and off-screen sexual violence, and is being shown at the Park City Film Series at the Jim Santee Auditorium September 26th through 28th. So, should you see it? Heck yeah! For the KPCW Friday Film Review, this is Helen Nadel.
Well, the Utah State Tax Commission is warning Utahns about a new phishing text message scam. The text asks recipients to provide their banking account for information to receive a supposed tax refund. The commission is reminding taxpayers it will never request banking information, Social Security numbers, or other personal data through text messages. The only way residents will receive tax refunds is through direct deposit they set up when filing return or by a mailed check. If you receive a suspicious text, do not reply to the message and never click the links in the message. Scam messages can be reported to the Federal Trade Commission and the State Tax Commission. Well, it is not just the chill in the morning that tells us that fall is upon us. Here to talk about the fall colors is Utah State University Extension Professor Katie Wagner. Morning, Katie. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And as you drove in this morning, were there some colors to look at?
There are some colors. On the higher elevations, I was seeing some nice colors.
So, Katie, when do we normally start to see the leaves begin to turn?
It depends on where you are in the state. I'm down in the Salt Lake Valley area, and for there, we're seeing kind of the beginning part of October. We're starting to see some of our fall colors in the higher elevations now, and then later into the fall, we'll start to see the colors changing in southern Utah.
And again, it's what, late September? Is this normally when we would start to see things? Does it vary by much year to year?
Yeah, you know, the vibrancy of colors can vary, but the timing actually is pretty standard, because really what triggers fall color, for the most part, is the shortened day length and the lengthening nights.
So the trees are noticing that they have less daylight, so they decide, okay, this is my cue, essentially?
Correct, yeah. So, you know, chlorophyll is produced in the leaves of trees, and that's, of course, what the tree uses to make energy for itself. And so what you're seeing masked pigments that were always in those leaves. It's just the chlorophyll was dominating them, so you couldn't see them before. So as the chlorophyll production goes down, we start to see things like carotenoids and anthocyanins, which were in the leaves the whole time, but you see that as our fall color and our vibrancy. Yeah.
It's really interesting. I never really thought about why do the leaves turn. And the answer is, it's not so much that the new colors are being added, it's that the green is fading out.
That's correct. Wow. Yeah. And so the trees are starting to shut down for the season, right? Mm-hmm. They're starting to bring the resources down into the parts that are going to overwinter. And then they, of course, will have the energy to refoliate in the springtime.
Now is the timing for the leaf changing, does that vary across the state? Do we see it at different times across the state?
Yeah. So as you're going to different places across the state, you are going to see that timing change a little bit. Absolutely.
Okay. And, you know, I asked you a few minutes ago about the timing. How about the vibrancy? Does that vary significantly from year to year?
It does. There are a lot of factors that go into vibrancy. So it can be the species of the tree is, of course, one big one. It can be the how much moisture. So moisture actually is a big driver for that. Good vibrancy in fall color really is best if we have kind of consistent moisture throughout the growing months. And so it even goes back into the winter periods if we have really good snowfall in the winter, moisture, spring moisture, and then summer moisture as well. And of course, this year we didn't have very good summer moisture, and so we're probably not going to see as vibrant a fall color as some other years.
Now we had reasonably good winter moisture, but it has to be consistent throughout the year.
Yeah, it really can't just come at one point in time in the year. It kind of needs to be that good, adequate soil moisture for the plants throughout the growing season.
So we expect a sort of a B-plus year this year?
Probably a B-plus year this year. Weather can also have a factor, too. And so actually, if you get a lot of moisture in the fall and cloudy conditions, and that can affect the vibrancy as well. And another thing that we're seeing a lot that people don't necessarily notice is that because we had such a dry summer, we're seeing a lot of leaf scorch or marginal leaf burn on the tips of the leaves, and that's where it's difficult for the leaf to fully hydrate out to the margins, and so you'll see that natural browning. And that's just an adaptation to those weather conditions, but because you have that browning on the edges of the leaves, you're not seeing the color, and so overall you see less vibrant leaf color in the swaths of color that we're looking at in our mountains.
So let's talk about some of the trees that, you know, have different sort of color shows for us. Which ones do you find to be the most spectacular?
Yeah, so when you're driving through the canyons, when you see, of course, those big golden swaths, those are quaking aspen. It's our Utah State tree, and they're gorgeous. They're colony forming tree species, and so you get to see a lot of color in those kind of painter strokes that you see as you're moving through the canyons. But my personal favorite is our native maple, which is the big tooth maple, which has beautiful, it actually can vary quite a bit, but it has red to orange to yellow hues in it. And then also our gamble oak can produce some really nice sort of reds and purples as well. So those are some of my favorites.
And where do you like to go to look at them here in northern Utah?
I like to kind of just do some canyon drives. If you can get out and you can hike, sometimes that's the best way to see the fall colors, in my opinion, because sometimes you get these little hidden pockets or you get these really beautiful specimen trees mm-hmm. that you're not necessarily going to see from the roadside. And so that's my favorite way to enjoy them.
And if I'm a northern Utah sort of leaf enthusiast, what weekend should I be sort of penciling in for the peak?
Let's see. Northern Utah, we're getting there now. And so if you're going up into higher elevations, then I would encourage you to go out. You're probably going to want to start up higher And then as the season progresses, you can move down closer to the valley floors. But, I mean, this would be a great time to go check out Logan Canyon and see what you can find up there. Yeah.
And what about Southern Utah?
Southern Utah is going to be later. You're looking more into the latter part of October, even into November. We're going to see some colors there. So that's kind of the nice thing is that you can almost like, if you're really into this stuff, you can plan your road tripping around, you know, where you're seeing those colors. And there are some websites. SmokyMountain.com is one that a lot of people use that actually don't just follow the Smoky Mountain region area, but throughout the country. And it'll kind of give you an idea of when you can see those peak colors. So check that out.
And Katie, do you have some favorite spots in Southern Utah that you would recommend to see a good leaf show?
Favorite spots in Southern Utah? Yeah, oh my goodness, I'm trying to think here. I don't know that I have one in particular in mind. I'm sure we have some listeners that are just going, oh my gosh, she should say this spot. It's the most amazing spot. Yeah, I don't know that I have one in particular in mind. Do you have one?
I am not a big leaf guy. Although this discussion has sort of made me intrigued enough so that I will probably find time this weekend to go walk up the mountain and have a look.
Yeah, make sure you're getting to areas where you are going to find those species of trees that we do find good color in. So you are kind of getting up into the mountains and that type of an area is where you're going to see more of these things growing. They like to hang out in the canyon
areas. Well, we actually see different trees. Are there significant differences in species we'd see between northern and southern Utah in terms of the trees?
There's going to be some speciation. The ones that I mentioned we're going to see, more or less throughout the state. But, yeah, there will be some things.
So, sure. Katie, what does your sort of office or what do you do the rest of the year?
Yeah. So we do a lot of things with the Extension Office. We do a lot of diagnosing of people's plant problems, actually. And so we're a service that provides that. We run the Master Gardener Program, which is quite a large program for us in Salt Lake County. But I get to just get involved in all kinds of fun sort of research projects and things that are happening. Sometimes I'll work with some of my colleagues on campus and we're looking at, different things that are of interest from a horticultural perspective of the public and trying to figure out some of the research behind that. So it's really awesome because actually I get to do a lot of different things and it changes seasonally, just like the leaves, right? Just like the trees.
Katie, last question before we go. Which research project are you most excited about right now?
I'm most excited about a research project that a colleague of mine is running that is really looking at implementing what's called TWCA turf grass, which is Turf Grass Water Conservation Alliance. There are particular cultivars that have been picked for our Intermountain West region that have improved heat and drought tolerance. So people that want to keep their turf, once established, these cultivars, they look and behave a lot like the ones that we're used to growing, but they can survive and actually thrive off a 30 to 40% decreased water use.
And I take it, I can't help but sort of follow up on that. I take it that among the things you guys are looking at is helping people create landscapes, home landscapes that are less water intensive.
That's right. Okay. But also to keep the appeal because, some people are willing to say, okay, I just am totally in, I'll go this direction. Some people are like, I don't know that I'm ready for that. And so it's really great to offer people different choices and to use these types of new technologies that come on board.
And if we've intrigued somebody about the potential for helping do that, helping to find these kind of landscapes, is there a way to reach out to Utah State?
Yeah, there is. And we have a great website. It's the Center for Water Efficient Landscaping, CWEL.org. You can go there and then you can find more information on those.
Katie Wagner, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
All right, I'm going to go out and look at leaves this weekend, are you?
Of course.
We'll be right back after this. Main Street business owner John Kenworthy has pulled out of the Park City Council race. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports Kenworthy narrowly made it through the primary election.
John Kenworthy filed a withdrawal affidavit with City Hall Thursday, leaving three candidates in the November Park City Council election. His name will still appear on the ballot because overseas ballots have already been mailed, according to Park City recorder Michelle Kellogg. Any votes for Kenworthy will not be counted. The Summit County Clerk plans to send emails to all voters with listed email addresses and will post signs at polling locations notifying voters of his withdrawal. Park City Municipal will also send social media reminders that he has withdrawn. The remaining candidates include incumbents Tana Tolley and Jeremy Rubel, along with political newcomer Diego Zagara. Kenworthy narrowly made it through August's primary election, in which the top four candidates advanced. He beat Beth Armstrong for the fourth spot by a margin of 25 votes. Kenworthy has campaigned alongside Rubel and mayoral candidate Jack Rubin throughout the election. A former planning commissioner who also chaired the city's historic preservation board, Kenworthy was the subject of a controversial letter to the editor published August 2nd in the Park Record. The letter, signed by current and former elected officials, including Park City Mayor Nan Worrell, accused Kenworthy of making misogynistic remarks about Tolley. At a candidate forum days later, Kenworthy called the letter a political hit job and said the election had created a toxic environment. In a statement issued Thursday, Kenworthy said, quote, "I will keep working for Park City in ways that are constructive and unifying," end quote. Kenworthy plans to communicate directly with donors and return all campaign contributions, according to a press release. Financial disclosure forms from August show Kenworthy had spent over $11,000, most of which was his own money. Parkites will elect two council members and a mayor November 4th. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Well, Tepper HaShalom in Park City recently welcomed a new rabbi. Joining me in the studio now is Rabbi Jeff Dreyfuss. Good morning, and thanks for being here.
Good morning, thanks for having me.
So, before we get to sort of what's going on this week, the next week, can you share a bit about your background and the path that led you to Park City?
Sure, well, I'm thrilled to be here. Temple HaShalom and Park City are just such wonderful places. I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, and...
No Southern accent.
Well, it comes out maybe when I'm around my grandma and my cousins. But I grew up in Memphis, and actually worked in finance and in a startup before becoming a rabbi. One of my student pulpits was in Juneau, Alaska, and I was really lucky as a kid to be able to come skiing and to be in beautiful places, but I always thought about they're places where people go on vacation, not places where people actually live. And being in Juneau and after Torah study on Shabbat morning, being able to take hikes with my congregants in these spectacular places, I realized for the first time, wow, people actually live in a place like this. And that really just inspired me someday to be able to live in a place with natural splendor, with natural beauty, like Park City.
Okay, and your last pulpit was in Memphis?
It was in Memphis. Actually got to serve the pulpit I grew up in. My family's been a part of that community for six generations. And it was hard to leave.
I was gonna say, that might make it a little hard to leave.
It was hard to leave, but the mountains were calling. Rachel and I, my wife, skiing is our favorite thing, so we're thrilled to be here.
Okay, Jeff, for some people, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, those are Hebrew words that simply designate the day the Park City schools are closed. can you explain a little bit, I want to talk a little bit about what each of the holidays mean, and first I want to ask you, why do the dates move every year?
Okay. So Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, they are two most important holidays in the Jewish tradition. You could also make an argument Shabbat, which comes every week, is actually the most important holiday. But these are our holidays of renewal. Rosh Hashanah is our new year, and Yom Kippur is our Day of Atonement. I'll tell you what they mean in a sec, but they switch every year because we operate according to the Hebrew calendar, a calendar which is thousands of years old, which is not only based on the sun, like the Gregorian calendar we use in America, but also based on the moon. So it's primarily a lunar calendar, but 7 out of every 29 years, I believe, we have a leap month, not a leap year, which is, of course, based on the sun. So it's called a lunisolar calendar, and it is a bit loony, but that's why the date switch. So Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are holidays of renewal. It's our new year, but it's not just a celebration like New Year's Eve. It's a chance to do what we call in Hebrew teshuva, to not only do repentance, as it's normally translated, but it literally means to turn or to return, to return to the person that we and our soul believe we're meant to be. And so this is a time of doing spiritual work, of figuring out who we want to be in the year ahead and how we can get there.
As you say, it's not sort of it's not sort of a let's have a party and pop the champagne at midnight. It is a time, I guess, take it for introspection.
Exactly.
Okay. And how do people commemorate it or celebrate it?
So, it's actually Judaism is a religion that is almost primarily based in the home. Every week we have Shabbat dinner. Celebrating and being with your family is the most important thing in Judaism. But these are two holidays where people all come to the synagogue. And so part of it is being in services in the synagogue, being together in community, realizing that, especially in our world today when we're on our cell phones and we're more connected than any other generation in the world, we're actually the most disconnected. So part of it is being together in community, but part of it is doing this work of teshuvah through a very ancient technology we call cheshbon ha-nefesh, which means a spiritual accounting or an accounting of the soul. And in order to do that, we take all of the deeds that we did in the past year, the deeds that we're not proud of, the ways we missed the mark, but also the things that we're grateful that we had the courage to do, the good and the bad, and we look at both of those and say, how do we do more of the good in the year ahead, and what are ways that we can leave some of the bad behind?
And what are some of the foods and the other sort of rituals that are associated with Rosh Hashanah?
Sure. So it is a joyous holiday. Rosh Hashanah is a joyous holiday. Yom Kippur is a somber holiday. And on Rosh Hashanah, we have apples and honey for a sweet new year. We actually also eat a new fruit, a fruit that we haven't eaten in many months. We eat it on Rosh Hashanah to symbolize the newness of the holiday and of the year. We have round challahs instead of oblong challahs. Challah is our Jewish bread. And it's round to symbolize the circle of life, that we have reached another, a circle doesn't have a beginning or an end, but another spot in the cycle of life. And so we have these round challahs. But it's funny that you ask, what's the food on Yom Kippur? Because there is no food. It's a fast day. Mm-hmm. And we fast as not as a way of punishing ourselves or limiting the pleasure, but actually as a way of saying, today is only focused on the spirit. It's not focused on the body. And so anything that the body normally needs, we don't do. We refrain from food and drink and the pleasures of the flesh, and we're just focused this day on the soul.
Now, you mentioned earlier social media. I take it that Judaism had a predecessor to social media, which is the way it would call people to Rosh Hashanah with the blowing of the shofar. Is that, have I got that basically right?
Isn't that
how it would summon people?
I love that. It's not like you get a notification on your phone. It's the shofar is an ancient instrument. We read about it all the way back in the Torah, thousands of years old. And it's a way that for all these millennia that Jews have signaled to each other, it's time to wake up. It's according to some rabbis, a spiritual alarm clock. And its call not only connects us to our ancient ancestors who have heard the very same sound for thousands of years, but it's a call to each one of us that the way that you've been living, the person you have been, doesn't have to be the person you are in the year ahead. And shake out of the patterns that you found your way into, and really with intention, with kavanah, as we say in Judaism, choose the person you want to be in the year ahead.
And what is a shofar? I know you brought one with you. What is it?
I brought one with me, and this is actually quite a large one. It's traditionally a ram's horn, or it can be the horn of any kosher animal. And this one, my wife and I actually got for our wedding as a wedding gift, so this one is special to me. We have a special person called a Baal Tekiyah, literally a master of blowing the shofar, who blows it every year on the holidays. Ours is Scott Edelman. Scott, if you're listening, thank you so much for being there this week.
We'll be interviewing his daughter later today about her sushi business, but that's
really?
Another story.
That's wonderful.
So, yeah, he's been doing it forever. And again, in ancient times, was it really sort of used to give notice to people? Mm. I mean, how did it work?
So, great question. On the high holidays, we have a specific set of sounds called on the shofar that we make. It also, in ancient times, was used to call the new month. So it's not like they had Google Calendar, and they didn't know when exactly the month started and ended. So they would actually have priests or scouts who looked at the moon to say, is this the new month or not? There could be some discrepancy. But whenever they decided this was a new moon, they would blow the shofar from one town to another so that people in the next town would know that in Jerusalem, this is where the new month had been determined. They also were calls to war. So we read in the book of Judges about the Battle of Jericho and that they were blowing the shofar and the shofar. They all blew the shofar at once, and then the walls of Jericho came tumbling down. Actually listened to, I think it was a Radio Lab episode once, testing out, could this have really happened? Could the sound waves have felled the walls? Probably not. But it has, and I'll blow it for you in just a moment, you'll hear it's a piercing sound that you can see would instill the gravity of the moment in a warrior about to go to battle.
And so in ancient times, it was used on more than just Rosh Hashanah. It was used almost every month.
It was used every month and for other occasions as well. Okay. But its primary ritual use is on Rosh Hashanah.
And did you have to learn to do it to get out of rabbinical school?
No. And actually, I'm not an expert at all in it. But there are people who have practiced and trained for years who are really can. And I think if you play brass and you have the aperture correct, then it's much easier. But anybody can do it. And actually, at the very end of Yom Kippur, our last blast of the High Holy Days, we invite anybody with a shofar to come and blow with us. So if you're a kid or anybody with a shofar out there and you want to come, and this is an invitation to anyone listening, if you're Jewish and would love to come to a High Holy Day service, we would really like to have you. So you can email our executive director, Deb Sheldon, deb@harshalomparkcity.org, and we can get you in for these High Holy Days.
And another ritual for Rosh Hashanah involves going to the water. Can you explain that?
Sure. So we have this ancient ritual called Tashlich, which literally means to cast off. And we cast off our sins with traditionally a piece of bread into a body of running water. It can be a stream or a river or an ocean. And it's a way of taking a little piece of bread, imbuing it with the notion that this represents one of your sins from the past year. It could be a sin of impatience or infidelity or any sin from the past year, taking a little piece and casting it off and saying, I'm not going to bring this with me. I'm going to leave this behind in the year ahead. These days, we know that adding a bunch of bread to a body of water probably isn't ecologically the best because the ducks or the geese will eat too much. So we use rocks or biodegradable paper. But you get the idea.
And then that is something that you will do at the end of the services on Rosh Hashanah?
We will.
Okay.
We will.
And let's talk a little bit more about Yom Kippur, because you've talked about it as a day of sort of recognizing what you've done in the past. Talk about what you're asking. You know, what is the communication with God about in terms of sins and atonement?
So I would say it is a day between us and God. It is a day in which we gather communally and confess, and we have these very long confessionals saying a whole litany of sins, that we were violent, that we stole, that we slandered, that we murdered, and hopefully none of us were guilty of all the sins, and certainly not the most treacherous or extreme ones, but we confess communally to say that these sins, these transgressions, even if we ourselves didn't do them, we know they happen in our society. And as Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel said in the last century, he said, in a free society, some are guilty, but all are responsible. And so we confess communally because even if we personally didn't kill, in our society, people did. And we have a responsibility to create a society in which people aren't driven to do these terrible things. And we take ourselves to account on Yom Kippur. But I would say that Yom Kippur is actually less about our confessing our sins to God, because there's a line in the Mishnah that says, on Yom Kippur, God automatically forgives all our sins between us and God. If we ate a ham sandwich, a ham and cheese sandwich on the Bima, in the synagogue, every Shabbat, every year on Yom Kippur, God will forgive that as long as we are sincere in asking for forgiveness. But a transgression, a sin between us and another human being, God can't forgive that. That we have to go to that other person and ask for forgiveness and sincerely want to change. And so I think this holiday of Yom Kippur is about introspection. It's about listening to the still small voice, to the piece of holiness, the piece of God inside of us that leads us to want to be the best person we can be. And that involves not only how we treat God, but how we treat other people. And how do we cultivate in ourselves the ability to be a better person to other people, to our animals, to the planet in the year ahead?
So it's both looking back and looking forward. It's how am I going to do better?
It is.
Okay. And traditionally, is this too is a day that is typically spent in the synagogue. And I know for many Jewish holidays, there many traditional observations were 2 days, but that's not true of Yom Kippur.
It would be very hard to fast for 2 days
exactly,
in a row.
Right.
But Rosh Hashanah is, in many Jewish communities around the world, celebrated for 2 days. Reform Jews, which we are a part of the Reform movement, which is the most kind of religiously progressive movement, we celebrate for 1 day, Rosh Hashanah.
Okay. You know I'm not going to let you leave without giving us a little bit of the taste of the shofar.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm going to do my best.
You are.
Here we go. Ready?
And I know the calls of the shofar have different names. Which one was that?
That was Tekiya.
Okay.
Which is, that's our spiritual alarm clock. That's the one to wake us up and inspire us to be better in the year ahead.
And I hope that we woke up our listeners, because that was quite an excellent job. I think Adelman's got worries, Rabbi.
Got a little competition this year.
All right. Thanks for spending time with
Thank
us.
Thank you very much.